Thanks for the invitation. It's a great honor to speak at the Collège de France, especially after your wonderful lecture on the BKL analysis of cosmological singularities. So what I will be discussing is mainly joint work with Igor Odnyansky and Jared Speck. And indeed, we will focus on the singularities, the cases where already mentioned by Professor Hainaut, where the singularity is indeed of Kastner-like, and there are no oscillations. So let's begin with the framework. So we will be focusing on the vacuum or massless scalar field equations, in which case they're reduced to this form. The main unknown is a metric, bold-faced G, with signature minus 1, 1, etc. Over a time interval, times some compact space, for us it will be the torus, of dimension D, larger or equal than 3. Okay, and as it is well known, these equations have evolutionary part, which is hyperbolic or has wave character, if you like, in 1 plus t dimensions. The initial data for such a system is given along a space-like hypersurface, if you like, initial time, t equals 1, and they consist of the initial metric, so the induced metric on sigma 1, which is Riemannian, its time derivative, because it's a second order system, which is geometrically represented by the second fundamental form of sigma 1, the initial value of the scalar field when it exists. So in the case where psi is equal to 0, we have just the vacuum equations. Okay, and its time derivative, denoted by phi here, on sigma 1 as well. So as we saw like 2 weeks ago, these initial data are not free. They have to satisfy certain constraint equations. So the Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint in this context are these. And it is well known, thanks to the pioneering work of Schoeke-Bruha and Gerock, that such a system has a well-posed initial value problem. And moreover, there exists a unique maximal solution for sufficiently regular, let's say, initial configurations. And when I say, so unique maximal here has a sense of uniquely determined from the initial configurations. Okay. So let's. So this is the framework, okay, and let's introduce the. Okay, rewrite, since we already saw the general solution, Kastner solutions in this setting in previous lectures. So we have a space-time metric, which is given by this form, defined over the half line across the torus. Here you can, of course, I mean, consider more complicated topology, but for technical reasons, we'll just assume to have the flat torus. Okay, and the scalar field is just a multiple of the logarithm. So B and the PIs are constants, okay? And they have to satisfy the Kastner relations that we saw previously. So you see that in the presence of a scalar field, the leading order, this constant B, can affect the range, the values of the Kastner exponents. In the vacuum case, B is equal to 0, and you just have that the sum of PI and sum of the squares is equal to 1. Okay, and in that case, we also suppose that P1 is less than 1 to avoid the flat solution, which is not so interesting. Okay, and in that case, there is a Big Bang singularity. The area, the volume of the time slices decreases, so shrinks as you t goes to zero. And moreover, there is the curvature blows up, so you can see that the curvature invariants blow up as t goes to zero. And one more characteristic of the singularity is that it's what we call space-like, so it's synchronized by a regular time function. Okay, so the gradient of the of this t is uniformly time-like, is minus dt, so it's regular uniformly all the way up to the singularity. Okay, so these are the explicit solutions whose dynamics we're going to study in this presentation. Okay, and of course, the interest, what we would like to understand, are the general dynamical solutions. And I just want to give a general picture about these solutions or the expectations of the behavior of these solutions, many of which have been referenced before in the class. So first of all, we have the very general theorem of Hawking, which tells us that if the mean curvature on the initial slice is negative in the past direction, the space-time is passed geodesically incomplete. Okay, so if you are here at sigma 1 and the mean curvature is negative, then in the past direction, you will hit some boundary of your manifold, right, the solution, in finite time. Okay? And, okay, the expectation is that generically, there should be a singularity there, meaning the curvature blow up, for example, like a true singularity. This is also motivated by strong cosmic censorship. And I say generically here because there are pathological examples which are everywhere smooth, like the Taub knot solution, but these are expected to be unstable. And the physically undesirable effect of smoothness here is the failure of determinism. So if you arrive at a boundary in finite time and everything is smooth, that means you can extend, you can go past that in ways which are not determined uniquely by the initial configurations, so you can have multiple extensions, multiple solutions, which, I mean, something that we don't want to have for a theory in classical physics, like relativity. So the presence of a singularity here sort of means that the solution stops, and it's one unique solution determined by initial configurations. Okay, then, the second question is, what is the character of this singularity? Okay, so is it, first of all, the causally, is it space-like or could be potentially null? Okay, so the expectation, as we saw in the class for the cosmological setting, is that the singularity is space-like. But, and this, for example, is rigorously confirmed, as we will see, in the so-called subcritical regime. In particular, the Kastner solutions are stable. And okay, this is the main work that I would like to talk to you about. But there are also other regimes, for example, in the interior of black holes, where generically there is always a piece of the boundary. So there is a similar problem in the case of black holes, when you have horizon, let's say, some initial hypersurface, then if, for example, you terminate at infinity in the exterior of a black hole, you arrive at the asymptote, a Kerr black hole with non-zero rotation, you will have at least always a null Cauchy horizon, So that's the theorem of the theorem of St. Luke a few years ago. So this shows that things are complicated, and there are very rich dynamics and multiple scenarios that can occur as far as singularity formation is concerned in relativity. I say generically here because, of course, there is the Schwarzschild singularity, right, which is space-like. So this is rotation equal to zero. And in certain symmetric regime, we confirmed with Alexakis that the singularity is indeed space-like. And then, even if it is space-like, and you have full degrees of gravitational freedom, so as general as it can get, you're in a regime where this, where there is this negative Kastner exponent, you can have even more complicated behavior, conjectured by BKL. So again, apart from the character of the equation, afterwards, of the singularity, afterwards you also need to study the particular behavior of the solution as you approach towards that singularity. And okay, you can have even then multiple behaviors depending on the context. Okay, so now we will focus on the Kastner-like singularities. So we assume the singularity is space-like, and we would like to be within a regime where the expected behavior is of Kastner type, so as we saw previously in the class. And these are the singularities that we can say now we understand very well, or quite well, to a sufficient extent. Okay, and the asymptotic profile, again, I repeat many of the stuff that we saw in the course. I hope it's not too boring for you. So the asymptotic profile, so here there's a quality, but you should think of this as being the leading order behavior of the solution. Okay, so this is not an exact solution, but to leading order, if it is Kastner-like, I mean, this is what you should think of, where the Kastner exponents are now functions of the spatial variables. The leading order coefficient of the scalar field, if it exists, is also a function of space. And moreover, the principal directions, omega I, these are not coordinate one-forms, but it's a linear combination of dxj, where the coefficients are also functions of the spatial variables. Okay, and then again, the Kastner relations should hold point-wise at each spatial point x. Okay, so that's rewriting the Kastner-like metric, singular metric. Okay, and I will repeat some of the heuristics that we saw in the class, which are due to the multiple collaborations of either three of the physicists or two in certain situations. I just call it BKL for short, but there is a series of papers of theirs, and Desmarais and Spindel later. So let's review the heuristics briefly. So we consider, let's say, a set of vector fields which is adapted on the eigendirections of the second fundamental form. In that situation, Kij is simply pi over t, okay, minus delta ij. As a consequence of the Kastner relations, trace k is exactly minus 1 over t. Okay, and the evolution equation for k, which k here is a multiple of chi ij that we saw in the course. Okay, so it satisfies this equation, where bold face G is the space-time metric, and G without a bold face is the induced metric on the time slices. So that's a Riemannian metric. So here, this is, let's say, the spatial Ricci curvature, and the second term is the space-time Ricci tensor, which, for example, if you're in vacuum, is equal to zero. Okay? Okay, and we would like now to plug in this behavior into the equations and see if it's consistent. Okay? So for that to be the case, you need the right-hand side to be less singular than t to the minus 2. Okay? So if the first equation there, if we ignore the last term, gives you this. And again, as we saw, if we want k to be like 1 over t, this side should be less singular than t to the minus 1 plus some positive number sigma. Okay? So in other words, we would like, I mean, the ansatz of Kastner-like behavior is consistent with the equations, the Einstein equations, if the leading order behavior is not affected by the right-hand side, okay? And as a computation shows, on the other hand, that we mentioned in the class, the spatial Ricci curvature contains terms which are, in general, as singular as t to the minus 2 times a combination which is a rewriting of the combination of Professor Renault, what we saw in the class, pi plus pj minus pb, where all the indices are distinct. Okay, so the maximum of this exponent, these combinations, enters as in the expression of spatial Ricci curvature. Again, in the general situation where you have all the gravitational degrees of freedom. Okay, and in order to for the whole thing to be consistent, you need this crucial estimate for the spatial Ricci curvature. So if this is true, then the right-hand side will not affect the leading order behavior of K, and just the general solution of the ODE in the left-hand side will give you the principal behavior of K, which confirms the 1 over T behavior from the ansatz, okay, of Kastner-like behavior. Okay, so that's all at the heuristic level. So we would like this combination of algebraic combination of Kastner exponents to be less than 1 always. Okay, and we could call this actually subcriticality condition. So the subcritical regime will be defined as a regime where the Kastner exponents satisfy this condition. Okay, and as we can see, as we saw already in class, the subcritical regime includes the scalar field for all dimensions, spatial dimensions, larger or equal to 3, when the scalar field is large enough such that the Kastner exponents are all positive. So if you compute this algebraic combination for distinct indices, you use the fact that the sum of the PIs is equal to 1, you get 1 minus 2 PB here, which is always less than 1 if PB is positive. Okay. And also, in the subcritical regime, we have an open set of Kastner exponents when in vacuum, when the spatial dimensions are larger or equal to 10. So that's the miraculous number that we saw in the class previously. Okay, so that's the subcritical situation. And as we again saw in the first class 2 weeks ago, vacuum in 1 plus 3 dimensions is not fails this to satisfy this condition, so it's outside the subcritical regime, because there exists always a negative Kastner exponent. Okay, and for this particular combination of Kastner exponents, we get something, a number, which is larger than one. Okay, so this violates, let's say, the subcriticality condition, and therefore you don't have the crucial estimate for the spatial Ricci curvature, which invalidates afterwards the whole ansatz of Kastner-like behavior. Okay, and the crucial observation by BKL is that this estimate is true when an extra condition is imposed, which exactly cancels the dangerous term that corresponds to this particular exponent, P2 plus P3 minus P. So this is like the omega that we saw in the class that's in front of the T2, the 2P1 term. Okay, however, this eliminates, in principle, one of the degrees of freedom of the solution. So it imposes a restriction, a condition on the functions, the coefficients of the metric. And therefore, the Kastner-like behavior is not expected to be generic in 1 plus 3 vacuum. And afterwards, okay, BKL went on and as we saw, introduced this oscillations to study the generic singularity. Okay, I should mention that if we have enough amount of symmetry, one expects that this condition is already satisfied. So this one degree of freedom is already eliminated, provided we have enough symmetries. So in the context with a lot of symmetries, one expects the situation to be Kastner-like and easier to study, and indeed, that's what happened in the literature, as far as rigorous results are concerned. Okay, so let's mention some of the mathematical results. So these are divided in the following categories. So one, the first one, concerns the complete resolution of the singularity formation problem in the so-called Gaudi case. So if you have a certain toroidal symmetry with two Killing fields whose orthogonal spaces are integrable, then we know that the singularity is Kastner-like, apart from a certain, so the first special case was done by Kruschel, Eisenberg, and Moncrief, and then Ringstrom proved the general Gaudi result, where he also noticed something funny. So apart from finitely many spatial points, the singularity is Kastner-like, but at certain, again, finitely many points, the behavior of the curvature has a peak, something like a spike, which is not really BKL oscillations, but not Kastner-like either. So, okay, I cannot say more about that. Then we have a second category of results, which are constructions. So, if you like, these are existence. These results show that Kastner families of solutions with Kastner-like behavior exist. Okay, and this is done by solving a singular initial value problem. So you go here at t equals zero. You prescribe the Kastner exponents and the coefficients of the metric, and then you try to solve for a solution which at t equals zero has the prescribed behavior. Okay? And this was done for the Einstein scalar field or stiff fluid system in three spatial dimensions for analytic data. So for when the Kastner exponents, the coefficients are analytic, you can use a, well, there is a method called function algorithm that relies on Kosicki-Valesky theorem that sort of constructs solutions. And the important thing is that these solutions contain the maximum degree, the full degrees of gravitational freedom, which, okay, although doesn't imply, strictly speaking, that solutions are stable, doesn't say much about the dynamics, it indicates that they're probably stable because they have the full gravitational degrees of freedom. Then we have a work by Damour, Henault, Randall, and Weaver, where they also constructed, so it's a similar method, but it constructs solutions for the higher dimensions in vacuum that falls again in the subcritical regime, and also various matter fields, which include a scalar field. So this is very general construction, again, for analytic asymptotic data at the singularity, including all the gravitational degrees of freedom. So if you like, this is a strong indication of stability, let's say, or that these are all, let's say, the solutions minus the analytic assumption of the Einstein equations, sort of all types of singularities in that setting. Then we have Kasner-like singularities constructions by Eisenberg Moncrief in 1 plus 3 vacuum with enough amount of symmetries, so for these classes which are called U1 polarized and half polarized here. So these do not include the full gravitational degrees of freedom, and they are consistent with the BKL analysis because they eliminate exactly the degree of freedom, the dangerous term, which is responsible for the oscillations, okay? We have also similar, so again, Kasner-like singularities in 1 plus 3 vacuum, analytic solutions, which have no continuous symmetries, but again, you put this dangerous term equal to zero by hand, and you solve from t equals zero onward, okay? So removing the analyticity assumption is something desirable, also physically, because you don't want, analytic functions are very rigid. If you know an analytic function in some neighborhood, you know it everywhere. So, okay, one would also like to remove this assumption and just have smooth solutions. It turns out to be a little more complicated to construct such solutions, but nevertheless, they do exist. And again, you put this dangerous function equal to zero by hand at t equals zero. So this is work, joint work with Jonathan Luke last year. Okay, there are many other constructions that I'm not mentioning here, which rely on similar methods. Okay, but these, let's say, exhaust the important cases that that we know. Okay, then there is a class of stability, so stability results of singularities. And this is very different from the previous category of constructions because the initial data are now prescribed at sigma 1, so t equals 1. And this is okay, it has to be close. So stability means that the initial data are close to Kasner, so not general solutions, but in a near Kasner regime. Nevertheless, it is the ideal problem that we would like to understand. So solving in the past and trying to control the solution, proving that the singularity forms somewhere and that its behavior is Kasner-like. Okay, so there are no oscillations. And in the near isotropic case, for the scalar field model, this means that all Kasner exponents are near equal to 1/3. And for the also for the stiff fluid with equation of state p is equal to rho. So this is a perfect fluid where the sound speed is equal to the speed of light. This is again, I didn't mention, it falls in the subcurrical regime. And also for very high, much higher than 10 spatial dimensions, these stability results were first achieved by Rodney Anskin spec. And recently we obtained the full range of Kasten exponents for the subcurrical regime, including a symmetric case in 1 plus D vacuum, which guarantees that this dangerous term is automatically zero, which I will explain what it is. Very recently, a different class of symmetry was also studied by Ames, Bayer, Eisenberg, and Leek. Again, in terms of the stability problem. So prescribing initial data away from the singularity and trying to understand how the singularity forms and what the behavior of the solution is at the singularity in the past. Then there are conditional results by Lott, for example, and Ringstrom recently, which do not really prove stability, nor they construct solutions, but they say if the certain important quantities of the problem behave in a certain way, for example, if the spatial scalar curvature, the scalar curvature of the time slices behaves in a certain way, then the singularity is of this type. So that's what I mean by conditional. So instead of controlling the solution and proving that the singularity forms, you assume that certain variable is forever bounded in a certain sense. Then, or a certain integral of that variable. Then the singularity is Kasten-like, or the singularity is oscillatory. So these are the type of results, conditional results. And then there's the last and most interesting scenario of the oscillations, which unfortunately, as also Professor Noh mentioned, is very poorly understood in a rigorous manner, mainly because it's a very complicated situation to study mathematically. And the only rigorous result, which is, let's say, satisfying, is by Ringstrom in the Bianchi 9 symmetry in 1 plus the vacuum for homogeneous solutions. So that means no spatial dependence of the solution. And then you have a system of ordinary differential equations in time, which you can study, let's say, with dynamical methods. But there are all, you know, the heuristics that we already saw in the class, and as Professor Noh mentioned, there are many numerics which support the BKL scenario in the cosmological setting, but not rigorous. No theorems, let's say. Okay, so that's the rough summary of known results. And now I would like to focus on the stability problem. So we are within the subcurrical regime, so we consider a Kasten solution whose Kasten exponents satisfy the subcriticality condition. So you mentioned, just to reconstruct the question, that here you have a lot of symmetries, yet the dangerous term is not eliminated, and therefore there are oscillations in this regime, and you're correct. So I was very vague. I didn't really specify what I mean by symmetries. So in fact, so here in this comment, so you always, it seems that you always need a certain polarization condition like this one. So for example, this means geometrically the condition by BKL that the planes that are annihilated by the omega 1 form, which corresponds to the negative Kastner exponent, are integrable. So you need certain integrability condition all the time with, let's say, continuous symmetries in order to guarantee that oscillations are excluded. So in this Bianchi 9 system, all, let's say, structure coefficients are non-zero. So in that sense, you have a lot of symmetry and there's no spatial dependence, but you miss this integrability condition. So this doesn't just, what I said about enough amount of symmetry doesn't do justice to the actual subtle point here, which has to do with a certain integrability condition. So we will see, actually, toward the end, that these, let's say, important quantities, structural coefficients that measure, that are sort of the dangerous ones, in the subcritical condition, subcritical regime, they are less singular. And in a sort of symmetric regime that I will present, they are automatically zero. So just symmetries doesn't mean much. So I should be more specific about this. But thank you very much for your question. OK, so now we return to the subcritical regime. We pick a fixed explicit Kastner solution whose Kastner exponents satisfy the subcriticality condition, either for the scala field in three spatial dimensions or higher, or in vacuum for at least 10 spatial dimensions. This is a legitimate assumption. It's an open condition on the Kastner exponents. We perturb the Kastner initial data on t equals 1, and we would like to understand the solution in the past. Okay. In particular, we want to prove that a Kastner singularity forms in finite time, and we would like to identify the asymptotic data and show that they're close to the background asymptotic data that we're perturbing about. So in particular, the final Kastner exponents should be close to the background Kastner exponents, which are constants. Okay, so some main difficulties include the default in question, where is the singularity located? So here, I should say that we abandon a lot of things that were automatic in our study of Kastner-like singularities in the other way around. So when you study the singularity at t equals zero, you assume already that at t equals zero, your metric has a certain form. Here, we know nothing about this. I would like to prove it. So it cannot be somehow invoked, assumed in the process. It has to be derived. And therefore, we don't know, for example, that the singularity will be synchronized with respect to a time function. Because in order to know that, if you know that you have a singularity, that it is of this form, then of course there exists a time function whose t equals zero level set defines the singular hypersurface. But if you solve the problem from t equal one to the past, which is this magical time function that guarantees this sort of identification of the singular hypersurface? So that's a problem. So in particular, if you consider, we saw in the form of the Kastner-like metric, we chose Gaussian time. So if you know there is a singularity, then you can shoot geodesics from t equals zero, and you have the metric given in this form. Okay. Now, if you try to do something similar for the stability problem, then Gaussian time, since the geometry will be different, there is no reason, and also I should say that, let's say, faraway points, spatial points, are not influenced, let's say, what will happen in the past is not influenced by what will happen in the past of x0, and x1. So for example, here you could have, let's say, the singular point happening before t equals zero. And here, with respect to Gaussian time, proper time, a little bit after t equals zero. So in principle, with respect to Gaussian time, t, let's say, tilde, will be a hypersurface which is close to zero but not zero. Okay. So these are, let's say, problems at an analytical level that you have to overcome in order to prove singularity formation. Then, because of the singular behavior that you're expecting to see, when you try to estimate a certain energy of your system that will control your solution, you end up getting very bad control of this energy, which doesn't give you anything useful. So these are certain obstacles that we have to overcome. And let's introduce some general framework before going to the analysis of the problem. So we're going to rely on a splitting of the metric with respect to relative to a time function, and such that the shift vector field is equal to zero. So again, we foliate, we have the time-like curves, which are, let's say, integral curves of the gradient of t, but we allow for a non-trivial lapse, which is an extra freedom. We can choose what the lapse should be, could be, instead of taking Gaussian time. Then we will work with a certain orthonormal frame, which is adapted to the level sets of t, meaning that E0 is always orthogonal to your time slices. Actually, the way I wrote it, it's the other way, but okay. EI will always be tangential to the time slices, okay? And I'm using capital indices for the frame and small indices, Latin indices, for the coordinate vector fields, okay, just to avoid confusion. Then, the frame satisfies the propagation condition such that it remains tangent to the level sets of t. And the main unknowns of for the Einstein equations in this setting are the second fundamental form, the components of the second fundamental form evaluated against the spatial orthonormal vector fields, and the spatial connection coefficients, which we will use to express the spatial Ricci curvature, which was in the right-hand side of the evolution equation for k that we saw earlier, and it's a convenient way of analyzing these terms. Okay, what I should note here is that this frame is initialized at t equals 1. Okay, so you choose it at t equals 1, and then it remains adapted to the time slices in the past. However, because we don't know where the singularity will form, the frame is not adapted to the eigenvectors of the second fundamental form. So it could be it's an arbitrary frame, which is close, let's say, to the Kastner frame, but it could sort of pick up any multiple of all eigenvectors. Okay, so this doesn't diagonalize Kij, okay, which is an extra, let's say, feature of the problem difficulty. Okay, now, as far as the first question, the very important question of locating the singularity, a main idea already comes from previous work of Rodniansky and Speck, and the idea is to consider a foliation sigma t, which is of constant mean curvature. So CMC. Of course, I mean, CMC conditions, the fact that these things exist and could, for example, for known solutions which are Kastner-like, such a foliation exists. Of course, this goes back a long time ago, and many people have studied CMC foliations. However, proving analytically that such a thing indeed synchronizes singularity and controlling the solution for the stability problem, this was first demonstrated in their work. And a reason, in analytic reason, let's say, that you expect somehow magically something which is defined from t equals 1 and propagated in the past to capture the singularity at t equals 0. At an analytic level, this is, or let's say intuitively, at an analytic level, this has to do with the infinite speed of propagation of the equation, the resulting equation of this gauge assumption. So this leads to an elliptic equation for the lapse of the foliation. Here I'm using the Einstein summation without raising indices to emphasize that this is an orthonormal frame. So this is Laplacian with respect E1, E1, plus C2, E2, plus EDD, etc. For the lapse. Okay, and the elliptic equation has a chance of homogenizing, let's say, the identification of the singularity. So, of course, everything has to be proven, but this is hopeful that the singularity will be at t equals zero relative to this family of space-like hypostasis. Okay, once you have assumed that, then you have fixed the lapse of your foliation, and once you have also chosen your orthonormal frame at t equals one, everything is fixed. So your gauge is fixed, and the Einstein equation is now reduced to a first order equation for k that we already saw. Here in the right-hand side, I'm expanding the spatial Ricci curvature, which will be this first-order derivatives of the gammas. Okay, here you have the Hessian of the lobs. Then we have an ODE for the frame coefficients. Okay. We have a first-order equation for the spatial connection coefficients, which in the right-hand side have spatial derivatives of the second fundamental form. Okay, so in that sense, gamma and k satisfy a first order PD. It's not an ODE. So this you can think of as a modified ADM type framework. So in the ADM formalism, you have the first variation equations for the metric that we saw in the class. Second variation equations for the second fundamental form that we saw in the class. Here they're expressed relative to an orthonormal frame. And we find it convenient to analyze the curvature, which can be quite messy if you try to express it in terms of the metric, to analyze it with respect to the spatial connection coefficients, which satisfy their own evolution equation. Okay, so that's the Einstein equations. And of course, you have a wave equation for the Scala field whenever it exists. Okay, this 1 over t, this very convenient factor here, comes from the CMC condition. Okay, so already putting trace k equal to something is convenient for the analysis of the problem. Okay, then what is the overall plan in trying to estimating, controlling the solution, the perturbed solution near the Kastner background. So one feature of the problem is doing an energy estimate, which is always required when you want to solve a PDE in certain, let's say, Sobolev space, but without writing any norms here. So you need an energy identity, okay, which can be achieved by using a trick of let's say, which is well known, using the momentum constraint. So this, what I didn't say is that the system for gamma and k is not symmetric hyperbolic. So you have to modify it to get an energy estimate. And the modification you need is using the momentum constraint to replace this divergence of k with things that are more regular. So at the end of the day, you get that the time derivative of your energy, which is k squared, gamma squared. Okay, here I'm using again Einstein summations. So here you sum over all I, j, b. can be written as a whole derivative of something plus other terms which are more regular. This means that when you integrate in space, you can integrate by parts, and you can try to control your energy from the energy itself, which will give you a Grundwald type estimate. So that's the general idea. However, due to the anisotropic backgrounds that we have to deal with, if one wants to prove stability for all the subcritical range of Kasten exponents, there will be a lot of terms which have non-integrable coefficients. So this coefficient here, that comes from the fact that you expect k to be like 1 over t, will give you a term which has a coefficient that is not uniformly integrable in 0, 1. Okay, so this blows up. As a result, instead of getting that, proving that your energy is finite, you prove that your energy can could blow up like a big negative power of t. Okay, so here I'm also including a certain number of derivatives which are necessary if you want to estimate the nonlinear terms in the equation using Sobolev inequalities, etc. But the problem is that this estimate is useless. I mean, this, you cannot control the solution. If this is t to the minus 100, this doesn't give you anything. But now the idea is that maybe you can get a near optimal control of your solution at, let's say, pointwise level. So you don't control everything in an optimal way. In fact, at top order, when you have a lot of derivatives, the very, very high derivatives will behave very badly, or at least you cannot control them. But perhaps at the zero, at the pointwise level, C0 or C1 or C2, whatever you want, depending on how many derivatives you have in the first place, can behave, can be controlled in a better way. So this can actually be done by using the equations as ODEs. So I will mention in the next slide what I mean by that. But overall, the plan, since this is unavoidable, so you cannot prove a better energy estimate unless you are near an isotropic regime, for example, where you hope that this C star constant is very small. The plan is to live with this. So this is the energy estimate that we will have for all derivatives. And try to get an optimal control at the very, at the C0, let's say, level. Okay? So, and then, if you have enough, sufficiently many derivatives, let's say 1,000 in your energy, you can control or intermediate derivatives between 0 and n using interpolation estimates. So if you have enough number of derivatives and you can always prove a certain energy estimate, I mean, the whole thing is consistent, provided that you can get the C0 control of the solution in an optimal way, which I will explain now. So once you have even a very bad estimate of your energy, the benefit is that when you look at the system of your equations, the way it's written, the left-hand side is always an ODE, first-order ODE, in T. And the right-hand side, which has partial derivatives, nonlinear terms, etc., this can be estimated using the energy. Of course, it will be very bad at the top order, but let's say if it's one derivative and you have n is 1,000, you can hope to get something better if you can control the C0 point-wise, the solution. So, okay, just to, enough for being technical. So here, at the C0, at the point-wise level, the whole point is looking at the general solution of the ODE, okay? Which is very easy. So the first equation will give you a general solution which is like 1 over t, a constant times over t, if you integrate. Okay. The second equation will give you a constant, which is initial data, times a negative power of t. Okay. For this, for gamma, it's a little bit more complicated. But in order for the whole thing to be consistent, you need always, you come back always to this crucial estimate for the spatial logic curvature point-wise, okay? And this is, as we can see, is equivalent to having integrable spatial variables. So if these spatial variables are less singular than 1 over t, then, for example, here you see that you have a product of two terms, so this will be less singular than t to the minus 2, and at the end of the day, you will have a spatial curvature which is less singular than t to the minus 2. Okay? So at the end of the day, it all boils down for the C0 control of your solution to have a general ODE solution less singular than 1 over t. Of course, apart from k, which is expected to be exactly 1 over t. Okay? So for the frame coefficients, this is obvious. All right, so the bottom line, the terms that can be very bad are the gammas. And these are related to the structural coefficients and the this omega term, C term that we saw in the class. Okay, unfortunately, these do not have a diagonal ODE part. So this is a system of for all the gammas. Okay, so you have a matrix, and you need to symmetrize it. Okay, now the key observation is to consider, instead of one gamma, a combination of gammas, which gives you exactly a structure coefficient. So this is the commutator of Eij in a product with Eb, and as you can check, is the sum of two gammas. Okay, now looking at the equation satisfied by this, just by adding two of the equations of the gammas, you come to the crucial observation that the left-hand side diagonalizes. Okay? In particular, the structure coefficients that have two coinciding indices, they have a general solution, which is t to the minus pj. And since pj is less than 1, this is part of our assumptions, is always less singular than 1 over t. Okay, now the most important term are the structure coefficients with all distinct indices. And you see that the general solution for this variable is exactly t to the minus pi, pj plus pb. So this is exactly the algebraic combination of Kasten exponents that you get in the subcriticality condition. Okay, and of course it's no coincidence because Ricci, as we saw, the spatial Ricci curvature is the square of gammas, for example. Okay, so this square of gammas will give you exactly the predicted at the heuristic level dangerous power of the Ricci spatial Ricci curvature, which if this subcriticality condition is not satisfied, for example, in 1 plus 3 vacuum, you get a general solution, a part of some of the structural coefficients, which is more singular than 1 over t, which leads to Ricci, spatial Ricci curvature more singular than t to the minus 2, and invalidates the whole argument. So what we need, the only part of the proof that uses the subcriticality condition is the low order estimate for this particular structure coefficients with all distinct indices. Okay, so that's really nice, I should say. Okay, so if these are, if this part is less singular than 1 over t, then we're done. So you get, you get this type of term, which is always less than 1 over t if, plus sigma, let's say, if the subcriticality condition is satisfied. So these are the Kasten exponents of the background solution. These are constants, okay? These are not the Kasten exponents of the perturbed solution. Okay. What happens in 1 plus 3 vacuum? Let's see here. Well, as we noted, there is a specific combination. Let's say that P1 is the negative Kasten exponent. such that the free part, the ODE part of S231 is of order t to the minus 1 plus 2p1, which is less more singular than 1 over t. And the coefficient of this term is exactly this, analogous to this omega coefficient that we saw in the class. Okay, so this is the term that can ruin the procedure that I outlined before. And if you have a certain continuous symmetry class together with a polarized integrability condition, then these terms are automatically zero, as we will see. So in particular, one nice, popular lately symmetry class that you can consider is what's called polarized U1 symmetry. So here you assume you have a translation symmetry, U1, one Killing field, okay, with T1 orbits, okay, and you also assume that's hypersurface orthogonal. In other words, the space-time metric can be written in this way, as before, only now the components of the metric do not depend on the x3 variable, and moreover, you don't have any mixed terms. There's no dx3, dx2, dx3, dx1, or dx3, dt. So this captures the fact that partial 3 here is both a Killing field and orthogonal to hypersurfaces. Okay, and in that setting, it's very easy to, by using this form of the metric, it's very easy to see that all the structure coefficients, in fact, with distinct indices, so it doesn't matter whether P3 is negative or P3 is positive, all these structure coefficients are zero. And therefore, these dangerous terms that could perhaps impede the whole scheme when the subcriticality condition is violated, they don't exist. So you can go on with the rest of the analysis. Okay, without changing anything. All right, so let's summarize what we achieved. And then, I think I have one more slide and I stop. Okay, so we consider a space-time metric, Kastner solution, okay, which satisfies the supercriticality condition, which is in particular non-empty or an open condition, valid open condition for the scalar field when d is larger or equal to 3 and all Kastner exponents positive, or when in vacuum when spatial dimensions are larger or equal to 10. Then perturbed solutions, which are sufficiently regular, let's say, satisfy the following estimate point-wise. So t times k, which is the second fundamental form of the time slices, is always near the background values, which is the diagonal matrix with the Kastner exponents of the fixed solution. T times the time derivative of the scalar field is close to B when it exists. The spatial Ricci curvature is always less singular than t to the minus 2. So we are in the subcritical, we have the crucial estimate. And all this relative to a CMC foliation. So the time function has constant mean curvature slices and trace k is equal to minus 1 over t. For all t all the way up to t equals 0. So t equals 0 is a singularity. And moreover, in 1 plus c vacuum, the same result holds when you are in polarized U1 symmetry. Okay. As a direct consequence of this theorem, you can capture the final Kastner exponents by taking the limit t times this k. So this will give you a matrix independent of time whose eigenvalues are the Kastner exponents of the perturbed solution. These are always close to the background Kastner exponents, provided the initial data are very close to Kastner. And the same goes for the leading order coefficient of the scalar field when it exists. They both satisfy the Kastner relations as a consequence of the mean curvature condition, trace k is equal to minus 1 over t, and the Hamiltonian constraint, which is valid everywhere. And the curvature blows up like t to the minus 4 here, this particular combination, the Kretschmann scalar. And as a direct consequence, the space-time is inextendable in a C2 as a classical solution past the t equals 0. Okay. So that's maybe perhaps I should finish here and we can leave time for questions. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you.